The headlines this hour. Iran grants emergency use authorization for its first domestically developed coronavirus vaccine known as Coviran Barakat. The Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya says that Benjamin Netanyahu's ouster closes the chapter on one of the, quote, worst periods of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the U.S. President Joe Biden says that NATO faces new challenges in dealing with China and Russia. Well, welcome to our studio here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran's health minister says the country's first domestically developed COVID-19 vaccine has received emergency use authorization. Saeed Namaki says the vaccine named Coviran Barakat will be mass distributed as of next week. The health minister also said the second Iranian vaccine, which is a joint project between Iran and Cuba, will receive the approval for use by next week. Namaki has noted that Iranian-made vaccines are among the most effective ones with the least side effects. Coviran Barakat received the emergency approval after completing the third phase of its clinical trial. Iran began its national vaccination campaign with imported vaccines in early February. More than 4.7 million people have received the first dose of a COVID vaccine across the country. Iran has added a new indigenously developed missile launching destroyer and mine hunter to its navy in a ceremony attended virtually by President Hassan Rouhani. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the latest developments with our guests. Let's take a look.
Iran has unveiled a new domestic destroyer and a minesweeper in the southern port of Bandar Abbas. The destroyer, named Dena, is the latest Moj-class frigate, fitted with different defensive and offensive systems. It's capable of sailing long distances in open water. The warship has a flight deck for helicopters. It can detect, counter, or destroy aerial and marine threats. Iran also inducted the Shaheen mine countermeasures vessel into the Navy within the same ceremony. The fully indigenous vessel uses the latest technology to detect and neutralize sea mines. President Hassan Rouhani, who participated in the unveiling ceremony via video conference, has hailed the achievement that was made despite international pressures.
Today, we witnessed the unveiling of two warships. The vessels have been made over the past years, proving that no pressure, no war can make us surrender. We'll continue our path. The strength and capabilities of Iran's armed forces are for deterrence and defense. We never sought any offense against other countries, and we never will.
Rouhani said that the power of the Iranian military is used to support the country's neighbors, not to be used against them. The Iranian president also hailed the independence of the country's armed forces, their advanced capabilities, and development projects. Iranian Defense Minister Amir Hatami has hailed the successful completion of the two new vessels joining the Navy fleet, and he says that the aim is to increase regional security.
We're making great equipment, and they can shoot from under the water. We have cruise missiles of ours that are now flying over 1,000 kilometers. We have great radars being built in this country, a host of military, a large number of military hardware and ordnance, all of which are being deployed on the Dena vessel and also the minesweeper. Well, they're also joining the Navy, and hopefully our Navy will be, Navy's power will be further boosted, both in terms of offensive and defensive operations and rapid reaction. Hopefully, we'll be able to bring security and protect our borders for Iranian borders and waters, and also those of the region. In light of this security and tranquility, hopefully, economic development will also be possible. I would like to offer you congratulations again. I congratulate the respected Iranian people and the Iranian Navy.
Okay, now time to get some insight. I'll be joined by a couple of guests. We have Karim Sharara, political analyst in Beirut. And also on the phone, we'll be joined by Samati Tarabi, director of Rosalat Strategic Studies Institute in Tehran. Good to have you both on the show, gentlemen. Karim, you heard the story. Iran is boosting its Navy prowess and generally military prowess, and it insists this is going to provide security for Iran and for regional countries. Let's have your take.
Well, I think this basically goes back to politics 101. When a when a state, any state in the world, feels threatened, it's going to try to boost its military arsenal. It's going to work on its defensive capabilities because it needs deterrence in order to keep war and military ambitions away. So basically what we have in the region is an attempt by the United States and foreign powers to surround Iran with military bases. I mean, you have Iran, which is completely surrounded by military bases, either from the east or the west. And you also have Israeli presence in the region. Iran and the people of the region feel threatened, and so they're going to actively seek out means of achieving deterrence, of increasing their defensive capabilities. And this is what's so unique about Iran's approach, is that it's only or mostly seeking to increase its defensive capabilities and not its offensive capabilities, because I mean, it's not pursuing the same policy that the United States is pursuing of attempting to control or neo-imperialism, if you will. It's not seeking to control the territories of the region. It's only seeking to drive foreign military presence away or foreign hegemony away. Now, this is on the one hand. On the other, you have this new development, which is a development in Iran's naval capabilities. And it's in line with the recent developments in the region, what with the Israelis targeting Iranian ships over and over again. So Iran needs to secure its waterways because this is Iran's strategic space. So the Persian Gulf is, of course, and Iran has stated this time and time again, it's their responsibility to secure the waterways of the region. It's not the United States ground. This is Iran's ground.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's not forget, it's not only Iran is not protecting its own vessels, it's also protecting others' vessels, like the one anti-piracy operations that conducted recently. Okay, on the phone, let's bring in Sam Ahtitorabi. Sam, good to have you with us. So Iran puts forward this Hormuz Peace Initiative, and this is the army commanders stressing that this is not a threat to anyone. Iran never initiated any war. We are on the defensive, and we need this for the sake of defense and maybe as deterrence, as Kerim Sharara mentioned. Let's have your take.
Sure. Well, you know, if you look at the Western policy in West Asia, American policy in West Asia is permanent and structural destabilization. And, of course, Israel is the main tool of that, but, of course, you have governments like the government of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates who are also conducting this, whether you look at Yemen or other places. Iran's strategy in the region is permanent and structural stability and stabilization. So Iran will increase its capabilities as it has done for the last 42 years since the revolution. Iran now went from being a vassal state of the Americans to being an independent international power. And of course, part of that is having a strategic navy, which is the goal of what we're doing now with the navy. The other thing is that Iran has very clearly and publicly and openly declared that its strategy is to expel the Americans from the region. Of course, that means also expulsion from the waters of the region.
Okay. I appreciate your comments. Kerim Sharara, political analyst in Beirut, and Sam Ahtitorabi, director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute in Tehran, joined us with their comments. And that's it for this news review.
Welcome back. Palestinians say the departure of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu marks the end of one of the worst periods in the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya said the new cabinet is as bad as the previous one. He noted that Israel's new coalition has no future if it does not take into consideration the future and legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also reacted to the election of Naftali Bennett as the new Israeli Prime Minister. It said regardless of the shape and color of the new administration, Israel remains a colonial and occupier entity. On Sunday, the Israeli parliament voted in favor of a new coalition cabinet, ending Netanyahu's 12-year tenure as prime minister.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yesha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be.
As a prime minister, Bennett will continue to act what he was doing as an opposition leader. We will be witnessing the same policies such as Israeli expansionist agenda, its strengthening of settlements and aggression on the Gaza Strip. And those policies will lead to more tensions and violence across the region.
Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against, and one abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023. Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The Russian president rejects as farcical Washington's allegations accusing Moscow of being behind recent cyber attacks against the U.S. Vladimir Putin said that the U.S. hurls unfounded accusations against Russia without bothering to produce any kind of evidence or proof. Putin made the remarks in an interview with NBC News ahead of his Wednesday summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in Geneva. Putin has already warned that ties between the two countries have sunken to their lowest point in decades. Washington accuses Moscow of interference in U.S. elections and launching ransomware attacks on the U.S. Last week, Biden said that Russia would face, quote, robust and meaningful consequences if it engages in what he described as harmful activities. The U.S. president says NATO faces new challenges in dealing with China and Russia as the alliance's leaders meet for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic began.
There is a growing recognition over the last couple of years that we have new challenges, and we have Russia that is not acting in a way that is consistent with what we had hoped, and as well as China.
Upon his arrival in Brussels for the summit, Joe Biden pledged renewed support for Washington's allies. Meanwhile, the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that China is not an enemy. However, he called on NATO allies to adapt to the challenge of Beijing's rise, calling it a systemic challenge to Atlantic security. Thousands of nurses and radiographers across Denmark will go on a strike on Saturday over dissatisfaction with wages and working conditions. The Danish Nurses Organization announced the decision, but it did not specify how long the walkout would last. The move comes after nurses' union members rejected a pay agreement between employers and union representatives. Over 65% of the votes were against the proposal, which provides for wage increases of just around 5%. An Egyptian court has upheld death sentences for 12 members of the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Two of the individuals sentenced by Egypt's Court of Cassation are senior leaders of the movement. The court reduced sentences for 31 others to life in prison. The court only interprets the relevant law and does not re-examine evidence, but its rulings are final and cannot be appealed. The Muslim Brotherhood held power in Egypt for 1 year before President Mohamed Morsi was ousted by a military coup in 2013. The group was declared a terrorist organization, and its members were given death sentences and lengthy jail terms shortly after the coup. The crackdown raised condemnation from the UN and international rights groups. The Pentagon Papers just marked its 50th year since being leaked. Former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned the Pentagon Papers, officially titled Report of the Office of the Secretary of Defense Vietnam Task Force in 1967. Small portions of the report were leaked to the press and widely distributed in June 1971. The papers exposed the U.S. lies about the Vietnam War, and for much of the American public, this grand deception seeded a distrust of government that is still prevalent today after 50 years.
Ngo Dinh Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and with the assistance of the U.S. began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This sound come from? Suppose it's a canary. This sound comes from the backyard. Oh, my neighbor, Miss Katayun, keeps some domestic canaries in her backyard, and this sound comes from there. They sing beautifully. Miss Katayun is interested in nature, so she has put a lot of green plants in her backyard and has named this place as the Little Hyrkanian Forest. By the way, have you ever heard about Hyrkanian Forest? Today, we are going to Golestan province in order to get familiar with Hyrkanian Forest. Hyrkanian Forest have remained from Cenozoic geology and Ice Age. These forests, which dates back to 25 to 50 million years ago, are among the most valuable forests in the world. Hyrkanian Forest stretch from Hyrkan region in the Azerbaijan Republic to Golestan province in Iran. These forests cover a total area of 2 million hectares in Iran, while the area of these forests in Azerbaijan is 20,000 hectares. 53% of these forests are in Mazandaran province, 26% in Gilan province, and 21% in Golestan province. Hyrkanian forests are among the most valuable forests in the world. In addition to supplying oxygen, these forests play a very important role in saving large amounts of water. These forests also enjoy a vast and diverse flora and fauna. Hyrkanian forests include 80 species of trees, 50 species of shrubs, as well as animals like panther, bear, goat, fox, etc. I am now in Golestan Forest, a very unique and spectacular forest in East Golestan province. This forest is a part of Hyrkanian Forest. It's interesting to know that these forests are famous as the living fossils. Walking in this forest is really exciting. Oh my god, this part of the forest has many, many beech trees. They are so tall and are grown densely, and actually I can hardly see the sky above. Oh well, I'd better not to raise my head so much. My neck is aching. Such a beautiful fox. Its head and tail are black, which specializes to this region. I'm very lucky to see a fox here. Oh, pity. It ran away as it realized that I'm here. Here, raspberry shrubs. Very, very delicious. I'd better pick some raspberries and give them to Miss Catayune as a souvenir from the real Hyrkanian forest. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide. I'm your host, Kovit Tafley. Every baby that is born brings with it promises of advancement and development for where they are born, which in some ways contributes to the economy. But what if that population was on the decline in a very major way around the world? Well, that is the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the headlines of this program: population stagnation, fertility bust, fact or myth? Have deaths started to exceed births? We will be checking out the numbers and see which countries are suffering from this, and of course, its economic impact. Then, the era of high fertility. Is it ending? But why? Is it because women have gained more access to education, perhaps, and contraception? Maybe migration to urban cities is the cause, or is the reason purely economical? In order to take a look at that, our next highlight is going to be case studies. We're going to be taking a look at countries. Which countries are suffering the most from declining populations? Is it China, which just allowed couples to have 3 children, or Italy, where maternity wards are shutting down, and Japan, was long been facing declining birth rates? And finally, one continent is going against the wave of low childbirth, and that is Africa. Countries there are outpacing the rest of the world, like in Niger, 7 children per woman, followed by Mali and Senegal. But believe it or not, these countries are on a downward trajectory.
The world population is always growing. The young and the old intersect paths. One group enters the workforce, the other retires. New ones enter this world. And the cycle continues. Most thought the world population had peaked, but there were warnings that it had entered a declining stage. Imagine entire regions where everyone is 70 or older. Imagine governments laying out huge bonuses for immigrants and mothers with lots of children. Imagine a gig economy filled with grandparents and Super Bowl ads promoting procreation.
There's a general viewpoint that a world with less people would be less burdensome on some key areas. Well, for starters, it is perceived that less people means more resources would be available. Climate change will not be as severe, and the impact on the environment would be less.
Just as significant as the increase in numbers is the fact that the global population is aging. Across the globe, the distribution of the population by age is shifting upward from younger to older ages.
But there's another side to the story when it comes to low fertility or fewer babies being born. It could actually have a detrimental effect on society. Fewer babies being born into this world would eventually translate into fewer workers. This would then mean that there would be more retirees. Just think about it. This could potentially turn societies upside down. The notion that a surplus of young people will drive economies and help pay for the old.
The majority, as I said, of the disaster displacement that we recorded is 98% of it is weather-related. So we can only expect, with the future impacts of climate change, for these disasters to become more frequent and more intense in the future, and therefore for the numbers of internally displaced people to grow.
Well, the population is declining, not increasing. The myth that the population is exploding and the world is overwhelmed with people is just not true. The declining population growth is all over the world. Just looking at the stats here, continent-wise, Europe's population is expected to decline the most by the year 2050, while Africa is expected to have the strongest population growth of any region. And the economic impact? That should be looked at through the lens of declining working-age populations, where you can see the projected change. European countries like economic powerhouse Germany and then Italy, for example, are declining, with Japan registering the most in Asia. But the OECD countries, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which comprises of 38 countries, shows a positive trend, even though that number is also in dispute. We have been covering how population decline can pose a threat to the world and its economy, but we haven't covered how that trend can be reversed. For that, let's go with Russia, since they're doing all that they can to prevent their population from decreasing. Boosting the national birth rate, well, that's a top priority for President Vladimir Putin, who has made this one of the key issues for his presidency, including cash incentives. For the country that tops the list in pushing countries to have, or pushing people to have children, that country is Sweden. Now, these are the stats which shows how determined the government is to increase its population. 480 days parental leave at 80% of earnings. Child benefits are 130 euros per child per month, increasing with each child. Now, you would think that would help the fertility rate. Believe it or not, it has not. The fertility rate in Sweden has actually fallen from 2.1 children per couple from 1990 to 1.6 for the year 2020. We're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up. Before we go for a break, here is a story of a man from Pakistan and his children, not one, not two. Well, it opens a window into why there is a rise and fall of populations around the world, in this case, a big rise.
Since we have low literacy rate in the country, so therefore our growth rate is comparatively higher than the developed country's growth rate, and we have more population increase with the passage of time as compared to the developed countries. Definitely we need to educate the population, educate the masses to have a reasonable size of the family size, so that all these requirements could easily be met, and your resources should be there to meet their requirements.
It's time now for a Q&A. Let's bring in Paul Sheldon Foote. He's a professor of accounting at California State University. His publications include biometrics, Sarbanes-Oxley compliance, and SAP ERP systems. Well, Paul, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what the New York Times has said, planet with fewer people could ease pressure on resources, slow the destructive impact of climate change, and reduce household burdens for women. But the census announcements from China and the U.S. have showed slower rates of population growth in decades, also pointing to hard to fathom adjustments. Can you name what some of those adjustments may be?
Well, it's easy to claim that, yeah, if you have fewer people around, that's fewer resources needed per person. But as I noted, if you have fewer people around and they're not marrying and they want separate houses or separate apartments, that takes resources. And we have the improvement of medical technology, people living longer. Well, people living longer have huge medical expenses. Also, they want to retire at young ages. And that means you need younger workers and plenty of them to pay into the Social Security system to enable retired people to live a decent retired life.
In an upscale Beijing mall, Chinese husband and wife are working out in a trendy gym. Good break from their hectic jobs. They are the younger generation of Chinese who spend life tending to themselves rather than following the tradition of having babies. Eating out is also part of that spending time together without the burden of a child. These kinds of couples are worrying the Chinese government.
In big cities, that's a clear trend, right? It takes people a long time to be educated. After they graduate from the college, they have to look for jobs and have financial security before they establish family and raising children, right? So this process is long. So I think Chinese people are getting married at rather late stage, right? And now it's also quite a risky business to raise children in big cities.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Did you ever wonder how many babies are born into this world every day? Well, we're going to take a look at an interactive that shows how many babies are born on each continent, every second, every minute, and every hour that passes. Let's take a few seconds to check it out. There you have the continent breakdown, East Asia and Pacific, Europe and Central Asia, Latin America and Caribbean. Let's see who's in the lead right now.
Looks like sub-Saharan Africa is in the lead, 1520, 1593. And you can see the numbers, how rapidly they're progressing. Believe it or not, these are the children that are coming into this world. Now, let's break this down. This figure may astound you. Around 385,000 babies are born daily. And breaking it even further than that, we're going to look at a number that calculates per minute. That number is 270 daily births that are happening per minute. Well, here's the UN on the population numbers for the future.
From an estimated 2.5 billion people in 1950, the global population has grown more than threefold and now numbers around 7.7 billion. Using demographic and statistical methods, we have projected the global population forward to 2100. Our latest projections indicate that growth will continue and that the global population could number around 9.7 billion in 2050 and 10.9 billion in 2100.
Well, the question coming from the opponents are, with 270 babies born each minute, how many people can the Earth sustain? That is the key question. So many people coming into this world. I mean, are these numbers sustainable? On the one hand, there are critics that argue the population of the world has long since surpassed what they have called optimal levels. That's on the one hand. But there's another camp that's countering that. They are saying that consumption is as important as population levels. And then you have others that argue another case, that overpopulation is coming out of the poor parts of the world with large growth rates and not at richer regions which use disproportionately high amounts of resources. Well, let's take a look at the truth. I mean, the truth really is that populations are declining. This warning, that is, was issued a long time ago by the UN, especially on how women had become more educated.
Gender equality and the empowerment of women are gaining ground worldwide. More people are living longer, are living healthier lives. More girls are in school. Fewer women are dying in pregnancy and childbirth. There are more laws to protect and uphold human rights.
And here is the former ECB Bank president, Mario Draghi, with his warning.
The euro area's working age population is projected to start gradually decreasing in the next decade. In that context, employment growth is likely to start decelerating in the not too distant future. Even with determined structural reforms, as a higher share of people in work will no longer be able to offset the fall in working age population.
You heard the words, they're decelerating, decreasing. Okay, the key here lies in the young population. You just mentioned it there, when it comes to the economy. Now, the young population can contribute vastly to the economic advancement, provided the governments invest in education, healthcare, and jobs.
The world's young people now number a record 1.8 billion. Never before have there been so many people between the ages of 10 and 24. And never again is there likely to be so much potential for economic and social progress. While young people have the potential to change the world for the better, they can do it only if they're healthy, they're educated, their capabilities are developed, they have rights, they have a voice, and they have real opportunities and choices in life.
A lot of ifs there. Well, there are three predictors that contribute to the decline that we have been mentioning in fertility rates. The first predictor is urbanization. Housing is much cheaper in urban areas, like on a farm. A child is useful labor there, and housing is cheap. And in the city, there's less work, so as populations urbanize, their birth rates fall. Now, the second predictor is women's education, and basically the better educated a woman is, the less chances of her having children, because they are not great for careers. That's just how it goes. And the third one, believe it or not, is religion. The more religious you are, more chances you have of having more children. Okay, we need some clarification. We need some enlightenment here about some of the facts. Our guest, William Beeman, joins us. Now, William Beeman is an American scholar and a professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota. He has authored many articles, 14 books on Iranian politics, theater, language, and culture. But William Beeman, welcome. The New York Times says all over the world, countries are confronting population stagnation, that there is a fertility bust, that's how they described it, a reversal, unmatched in recorded history. Obviously, this didn't happen overnight, and it wasn't because of COVID-19. What leading factors do you attribute for this phenomenon?
There are two factors that we need to take into account. First are biological factors, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The second are social factors, and the social factors are perhaps the most important aspect of this. After all, in the world, only women can have children, and so changing patterns of employment and choices that women make about their lives have greatly impacted the birth rate of families throughout the world. Let me take Japan as a case. We've known that the population in Japan has been declining for some time. It used to be that unless a woman was married in Japan, she had no social role. In the 1970s, after a woman was 29, she could no longer actually even stay within the workplace. They would essentially fire her because she wasn't young enough any longer.
India's population stands at approximately 1.38 billion people. The UN says its population might exceed China in the year 2028 to reach 1.45 billion.
The rising population is one of the biggest threat to our nation as well as our universe also. And I don't know why the government has not taken any measure. I'm not particularly pointed any particular government right from the beginning.
The UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, when he was the mayor of London, once boasted about how the population in the UK, particularly London, was experiencing a population boom.
Growth is inevitable in London. London's the biggest city in Europe, in Western Europe anyway. It has huge population growth.
But things did not turn out that way. Brexit and COVID-19 dealt a blow to the population increases. But the UK is not alone. In all of the EU, the population is aging, while at the same time, birth rates are falling.
There definitely should be concern because early action is needed. But what we've shown is through myriad measures, ranging from labour market participation to fiscal issues to solving vulnerability to poverty to combating the health challenge, countries can actually do a lot.
In Niger, the population is exploding. It is projected to increase from approximately 23 million in the year 2019 to around 30 million by 2030 and to reach 70 million by 2050. The reason? Religion. But the population boom has made many regions become food insecure. In Italy, the population decrease has reached a point where a town on the island of Sicily is selling off dozens of homes for just €1 to increase the population and to revitalize the economy. Japan has been experiencing a population decrease for quite some time. The number of births fell to a little over 8 million in the year 2020, down 2.8% from a year earlier, and the lowest since records began in 1899.
This will be a problem because it will affect Japan's society and economy. Last April, there was a report that the number of women are declining. Especially in the rural areas, the number of young women are decreasing. Therefore, it is said that the rural areas could disappear and become difficult to administer.
Time now for our Infant News, a section of the program where we review some of the stories that we believe were worth mentioning here. Now, we've covered it before because it keeps popping its head in the news, and this is the story of the dollar. We call it the unfair dollar, and this means the U.S. dollar has political problems. Investment guru Jim Rogers has said that. Now, what they do is, according to him, the U.S. gets angry, and when it gets angry at you, they use sanctions, the Islamic Republic of Iran being the forefront of that. They say that you cannot use it. This is while international currency is supposed to be neutral. Well, that shows just the U.S. and how it treats the dollar as leverage. Next, G7 tax breakthrough is what was announced just days ago. The G7 nations reaching a historic deal on global tax reform. Well, the group of seven have backed the U.S. proposal that calls for corporations around the world to pay at least 15% on earnings. Now, the key word or the key phrase is at least. Why is that a key phrase? We're going to go to the next item to find out exactly what relevance that has. The relevance comes here. When it comes to U.S. taxes, well, you have six U.S. tech giants that paid almost $100 billion less in taxes from the years 2011 to 2020. That's the news that came out of the States. I mean, the U.S. needs to get its own house in order before it can claim success outside of its borders. That's just a recommendation. Well, we here at Economic Divide have brought you this story last month, and we will again highlight this very important development that has to deal with food inflation. Global food prices have posted the biggest jump in a decade. By how much? The surge is quite a lot. You take a look at it, it's going to come up in a second. You're looking at a surge that is in the area of 40% in the cost of agricultural commodities, which in turn has raised the specter of accelerating inflation. The fact that populations are declining is not a positive development. However, it's not the end of the world either. Shrinking populations generally tend not to have a middle ground. However, this is only a temporary state, albeit that it takes time for it to balance itself out. Countries have to learn to adapt themselves to the changing population landscape. Now, as we covered in this program, governments need to make sure that money and resources are spent especially in rural areas to make sure that mass urbanization doesn't take place or takes place at a moderate level. And finally, fair distribution of wealth needs to occur so that economic worry or costs are lessened. But how can that happen when the world's billionaires, around 2,000 of them, have more wealth than 4.6 billion people who make up 60% of the planet's population? That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you. From Ikovit Halfway, it's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BADR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.